tonight is transitional objects, gold, silver, and ETM East Ryan. Bree mentioned I'm working on my dissertation. I'm working on Bayuka Raba, which, as I mentioned to Beverly, is not quite the communal topic as much. Doesn't hold as much interest, and so I thank you for giving me the opportunity to prepare this tour. I had a lot of fun, and it's actually a subject that has occupied my interest for many years, and I came across one of the midrashim that I'm going to share with you tonight. And in doing research for this year, I found out that there is just a wealth of information on the topic with all different vectors. At one point, I was so overwhelmed by the material that I actually wrote out a map of ideas because there were 6 or 7 different vectors. I'm not going to overwhelm you with all of them. But I do want to point out in the beginning a few that you probably are more familiar with in this topic. The topic being, of course, the Klei Chesed v'Klei Zahav, the gold and silver that the Jewish people were commanded to ask for from the Egyptians on that famous night of departure. And I would say that perhaps the most famous issue that comes up with this, or the cluster of issues, are the ethical questions. How could the Jewish people have asked or borrowed when clearly they had no intention of giving it back, right? Maybe you have never thought of that question, but it turns out that this is a question that occupied most of the Mefarshim that I found in the Torah Chaim. Ibn Ezra, Rashbam, Rabbeinu Hanan, now all point to probably live debates, I'm assuming, because they use phrases like, you should say this to the Minim, right? Or Yesh Shoalim. There are those who ask, how could the Jews have stolen? This is what you should say. And the overwhelming answer to that particular question is, clearly they weren't asking. Clearly they weren't asking to borrow. They were asking for a matana gemura. They wanted an all-out gift. And there are linguistic supports for how vayashilum could be that sort of request. But essentially it's a polemical response. Right? This is very troubling. Maybe we're not as troubled if we think about the fact that the Jews were leaving slavery, forced slavery of many hundreds of years, and so what's a little bit of gold and silver between slaves? But this is a question that was raised also in the Gemara. The Gemara tells a very lengthy story about one Jew who defends the Jewish people against the Egyptians in front of Alexander the Great. Clearly a fictional story, but a very interesting response to this problem. Again, the ethical question of how do you ask for gold and silver that you're not intending to return. I would say that tonight the main issue that I want to talk about is probably called the psychological. The psychological aspects of this particular encounter, or the commandment of the encounter. What was the goal of asking the Jews or telling the Jews to ask for gold and silver? Right? What function does it play in the narrative? Why were they told this at the very beginning, which we'll see in a moment? And I want to really get to the heart of the matter. You will probably, if you have read Aviva Zornberg's book on the Book of Shmos, you might find some of her questions percolating through my shiur. I'm very influenced by her way of thinking. And her question of redeemability. Were the Jewish people responsible in any way for the Geula, or were they just pawns in their own experience? Were they subjects? Right? Did they do anything to merit or warrant their yitziyah, or were they merely pawns in a larger narrative to which they had no active, no part, no agency? And this question of the gold and silver, I think, allows us to enter that question in a new way. To think about the Jewish people as subjects or not subjects, to think about what role they played in their own geula. And it also allows us to take a very long view of the story of Shmot, stretching into Bereishit, and as you'll see, even through Yechezkel. Okay, so in an hour, I hope to share some of those ideas with you. So let's dive into the psukim. On your first page, you have the three sources. This is it. The three sources that mention the gold and silver. In fact, if you weren't a careful reader or you weren't at tonight's shiur, you almost could miss the gold and silver. They're tucked away. The story of Shmot is so dramatic. There's so much going on in all of these prakim that the gold and the silver is really minor in the grand scheme of things compared to the plagues, right? Compared to Makat, the Chorot, which we'll see is right before the second two references. But here we have it. Okay, so the first source is Shmot Per Gimel, and just to reorient you, since you don't have a Tanakh, this is right at the end of Moshe's conversation with Hashem at the Sinai. And in a very crass way of summarizing these psukim, it says if God announces himself to Moshe, identifies who he is, tells him what the problem is, gives him the job description, and then says, they'll ask for gold and silver. Right? In this very dramatic episode, at the very end, we get the gold and silver. So let's just read a few psukim before the end. Let's start with Pasuk Yud Zayin. Actually, would anybody like to read? I know there's no vowel, but it's a very literary crowd. Okay, thank you. Pasuk Yud Zayin.
Va'amar Eleh, Va'amar Eleh, Tzlem Me'enei Mitzrayim, El Eretz HaKnani, Va'atiki, Va'amari, Va'atiki, Va'atiki, Va'yubisi, El Eretz HaVatim, Va'atvah, Shan'u Kolpa, Uvata Atav, Tiknei Yisrael, El Melech Mitzrayim, Va'amar Kamelav, Hashem Elohea Yidrim, Nikre Eleinu, Va'ata Anokan Na Derach Shloshet Yamin, Va'migar, Nisbukha La'ashem Elohim. Va'ani Yadati, Ki Lo Yitain Etzlem, Melech Mitzrayim, Va'ala, below the Yatakaka. The Shalati as Yadi, the Kiki at Mitzrayim, the whole Miss Otai, Asher as Zabir Kerbo, the Haritha and Yishalach of Mitzrayim. The Natati of Saint Ha'am Hazeb, the Ene Mitzrayim, the Hayaki Telfun, Lo Telfu Rekam. The Sha'Allah, Isham, Mishkanta, Ega, Gita, Klechetta, the Flezaha, the Simlot, the Samtem, Albanechem, Albanechem,
Okay, great. Thank you. So this is the end of the speech that God makes to Moshe, and he spells out his plan. I'm going to lift them up from the suffering of Mitzrayim. I'm going to take them to this land. Of course, listing all those nations who are living there, I don't know why that's any kind of comfort, right? I'll take you from Mitzrayim, and then you'll meet seven other nations. But this is where we're going. They're going to listen to you. You're going to go, and you're going to tell them what you need to say. I know that at first Paro won't listen to you, but then I'm going to send my hand, and we know the story of what happened. And then at the end, v'natati yasein ha'am hazeh be'inei Mitzrayim, and when they go out, lo tefu rekam. Again, telling him the end of the story at the very, very beginning. This is who I am. This is where you're going. And at the end, they're going to leave with a lot of goods. And then a very detailed, almost intimate Pasuk Chafet, right? V'shala isha mishchenta u'migarat beita. You get this image of each person knocking on the next person's door, right? The shchenta image, I haven't really gotten to the bottom of it. I thought the Jews were living in a separate neighborhood, so to speak, right? So this is making it seem as if it was a mixed neighborhood, or not, right? Or not really being that literal, but to me it speaks of the kind of, in each other's, kitchen image, right? They're going to just get in, they're going to get into the Mitzrayim at the very end. And they're going to ask for three things. Klei chesef, klei zahav, u'smalot. Very specific, right? As you'll notice, highly choreographed. Before we even begun to talk about how they're going to get out of here, there's no real description of the plagues. The three things they're going to ask for are already laid out. And then what they're going to do with them, v'samtem al b'neichem, you're going to take all this gold and silver and ship them on your kids, right? As we see later, perhaps even logistically, because what were the women doing? And the men? They were holding the dough, mm-hmm. Right? I read this recently and realized, oh, of course, the kids had to carry all the other stuff, right? If we're going to go down to that level, perhaps. And then the end result, when you pop them at Mitzrayim, Mitzrayim is going to be wiped, is going to be cleared out. So this is the command from the very beginning, and I really want to impress upon you that this is positioning this episode or this encounter as central to the whole Shmot narrative. Yeah. But I think you're 100% right. It's superfluous in the sense if they're going to take everything, we don't need to also know any problem in Mitzrayim. So there seems to be already a goal that's related to Egyptians, independent of Jews needing stuff. Okay, so let's keep that in mind. Great. Okay, then we're zooming ahead to Perek Yud Aleph. This is really just before the last of the plagues. And again, having read from Perek Gimel through Perek Yud Aleph, you could have forgotten about the gold and silver. Who cares about the gold and silver after what has happened? And especially, as Perek Yud Aleph announces, when Hashem says to Moshe, Pasuk Aleph, Od nega achad avi al paro v'al mitzrayim, achareta nishalach echem mizeh, kishalcho kala gareshi gareshi echem mizeh. Of course, once Machat Bechorot is unleashed onto the population, the rest of the plagues seem like nothing. Right? Although by the time you get to Machat Bechorot, it seems that there's nothing left. Once people start dying, once every family is grieving and mourning, the rest pales in comparison. And as he's unfolding to Moshe Machat Bechorot, we get again a reference to the gold and silver. Daber na be'oznei ha'am, v'yishalu ish me'et re'ehu, v'yishal me'et re'uta, klei chesef uklei zahav, v'yitein Hashem et fein ha'am be'enei Mitzrayim, gam ha'ish Moshe gadol me'od be'eretz Mitzrayim, be'enei avdei paro u'be'enei ha'am. Do you notice anything that changed since the first reference? Okay, so two important differences. Number one, men are introduced. In the original passage, it was just women with women, and now we have ish me'et re'ehu, also a change from shchenim to re'im. Okay, as if perhaps the relationship, hard to imagine as it were, but has progressed from merely neighbors to now more of a friendship. And then smalot has dropped out. Okay, so now they're being told daber na. Now it's about to happen. Before it was just right Moshe alone with Hashem at the Sneh. Now we're actually speaking about a live population that has to go house to house. And the details change a bit. Okay. The last instance is in real time when it's happening. So this is Shmot Perek Yudbet. I deliberately started with Pasuk Chatet Vayhi Bachatzi Halayla. Right? So this, the real episode takes place within the parameters of Machat Bechorot. Again, a kind of foil or, right, how can you talk about gold and silver when you're imagining the cries in all the families? Vashem Yikakol Bechor Be'eretz Mitzrayim. Okay, and Paro gets up, and there's a tzaka, etc., etc. Okay. Paro sends them out. The Mitzrayim and Pasuk Lamed Gimel are sending them out. They want them just to leave already. And then, Pasuk Lamed Aleph, Vayisa Ha'amet Betzeko, Ter Yachmat, Misharotam Surot B'simotam Al Yachmam, Uvenei Yisrael Atzu Kidva Moshe, Vayishalu Mitzrayim Klei Chesef Uklei Zahav Usmalot, Vashem Natana Chem Ha'am Be'inei Mitzrayim, Vayashilum Vayinatzlu Et Mitzrayim. So what happens from the previous two sources?
Smalot
are back. What about who's doing it? Right, now it's everybody. Now it's undifferentiated. So we don't know if B'nai Yisrael is an inclusive term here or not an uninclusive term, or exclusive term, as it were. Right? But what I really am interested in also is the juxtaposition of Lamed Dalet and Lamed Hei. Lamed Dalet is this pasuk, which is, it's so, right, it's mind-boggling. They're in such a rush, they can't even pack a sandwich. Right? This is, they're bringing their Mishar Rotam as their kneading bowls. Right? They're wrapped up in the clothing, but they're literally, they don't even take them out of the bowls. Right? Those of us who bake bread, they just pick it up, tie it on their shoulders, and they're out. And then we get this image of them asking and taking and schlepping all this gold and silver. Right? So at first it really seems like this contrast of haste with great, if not ease, at least great pain to take all of this gold and silver. But it does read as a kind of check, 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 right? Hashem Nachan Echein Ha'am, in fact, as he said, whatever that means, right? Vayishalum Vayinaslu. There we come back to what Bernie pointed out, when he saw them in Mitzrayim, which wasn't mentioned in the second source, but in fact it happened. Yes?
Wouldn't you say that the Pasuk says when they saw Asuk Yitzvah Moshe, that they didn't see it as an optional item, that taking the gold and silver was a command, actually, more than taking the gold?
Absolutely.
And hence, it wasn't something that you'd be surprised at.
No, I mean surprised, you're right. It's not surprising because they are following orders, right? But it's surprising in the juxtaposition of haste with great pain. Not that they could have opted out of it, but just almost if you were staging this as a play. You know, it seems really strange. That's what I mean by surprising. It's always interesting what anyone finds surprising about the Torah, right? Because it's there. We can't change it. We don't know why anything's there. But these two psukim right next to each other, haste versus great pain. Okay. So this is these are the psukim. All the questions come out of these psukim. And like I said, I think you could almost read it under the radar. Now, the way I group the rest of the sources is by A, B, C, D, and they're kind of different ways of explaining this whole issue. Okay, the first one I called covenantal fulfillment. If any of the titles seem strange, just blame it on my being a graduate student. But this one, I think, again, is probably the most familiar response, right, that you've heard. What's going on here? Why are the Jews being asked or being told, as it were, to take the gold and silver? This was already preordained, right? Hashem already told Avram about this. This is the brief they have carried, right? And if you look in Perek Tetzav in Bereishit, which is the first source there, Vayomer l'Avram pasuk gimel yadoa teda ki yer yezar acha ve'eretz lo lahem va'avadu v'inu otam arba me'ot shana. So Avraham gets the whole plan laid out in front of him. There's going to be all of this slavery, and then when they leave, I'm going to punish that nation, and they will leave your klush gadol. Right? How many people here heard that response in thinking of the gold and silver? Okay, everybody. Rashi in Shmot picks up on this, which is probably why we're all familiar with it, right, picks up on this idea of it being connected to Brit Brei HaTorah. So Rashi in Yud Aleph, which is in the Tzivui to the people, Daber Na, Ein Na El Lashon Bakasha, Bevakasha Mincha, Hiziram Alkak, Shelo Yomar Oto Tzadik Avraham, Vavadum V'inu Otam, Kiyam Bahem, Vakarechen Yitzu Birfush Gado, Lo Kiyam Bahem. Right? It says, if Who's the Bakasha Mincha? Who's speaking in Rashi? Not really clear, actually.
No.
Who's speaking? Daberna. Who says Daberna in Perek Yud Aleph? That's Hashem speaking to Moshe, saying, please, Hiziram, right? Please warn them. Please command this to them so that Avram, that Tzadik, won't tell me that I cheated him, right? I fulfilled only the terrible part of the promise and not the positive part of the promise. Okay?
Sounds
okay, you're just
really hits the point. That's my thinking face. You're
supposed
to remember that.
Okay. Hello.
It just really hits the point, but that's complete.
Good. Excellent. Right? This answer, which links the gold and silver to the Brit Brei HaTorah, completely swallows B'nai Israel. Right? Is that what you mean? They're not subjects at all in this drama. Forget the Egyptians, forget the Jews. We can't find any gold here besides it being part of this larger narrative, much in the same way that we could say that slavery was not based on B'nai Israel. It was based on this breed that was laid out in the time of Abra. Yeah.
And their point, this is who's controlling.
Sorry?
Who's controlling the point? Because this is the only time I can think. Hashem, every single other place, there's a place, he's commanding, they do everything. All of a sudden, over here, he's asking, can you, you know, please do me a favor, which doesn't seem to make, which is different than everything else. So if there's a pawn, that would be the Susikoda pawn.
Okay, great. So I'm asking you to think of this as being, as their subjectness being swallowed, but already it doesn't fit the pattern of the rest of what's happening. Is that what you're saying? In Mitzrayim. It's very clear, if you read through, you know, all the makot, it's very clear that this is, you know, Hashem's down and light show, and that everybody else are basically acting through the divine narrative. But then, why ask them to do it? Right? There is a kind of active agency on the part of B'nai Israel here. If it was just, and I'm skipping ahead a bit, but if it was just to get them the goods, couldn't he have done it another way? I mean, he does everything else, right? there wasn't another way to strip the Egyptians. He couldn't have fulfilled Abram's promise another way. It didn't. Why did it have to be that they had to ask for it? Okay, so we're going to get to that. But this response, which I think the first time we hear it, maybe seems like it makes sense, right? As the unfolding of Reb and Haftarim. It's very interesting that the Gemara that Rashi is paraphrasing, I think, in a sense, resists this explanation. So we have to look at the whole passage in the Gemara. Okay, so take a look at the next source in Masechta Brachot. The Gemara there is talking at length about the night of Yitzhiyah. Was it at night? Was it in the day? Right, really parsing out the experience of the Yitzhiyah. And here comes exactly what Rashi had just quoted, except Rashi didn't quote the whole passage. Okay, so just reading for quickly what we've just read. Daber nabav neha'am, amrei debei rav yanai. So now we actually get the house, right, or the group of people who are responsible for this idea. Eina ela lashon bakasha, amar le hakadosh baruch hu lemoshe. Here are the players, right, again spelled out. The bakasha mincha, please Moshe, leich ve'emor lehem liyisrael. The bakasha mikem, sha'alu mimitrayim klechatek ofle zahal, shelo yomar otot tzadik v'abadum v'inu otam kiyam behem, v'akar sheni tzir b'chush gadol lo kiyam behem. Amru lo, ulevai sheneitze. Now I'm not sure if to read it either ba'asameinu or ba'asameinu, right? But surely what they're saying is, forget the gold and silver. Who cares about the gold and silver? Let's just get out of here. So, right, ba'asameinu is more graphic, but saying, let's just get out alive. And the Gemara continues with a mashal. Mashal la'adam shahaya chavush bebeit ha'asirim v'ahiu omrim lo bnei adam. Motziin otcha lemachar mibeit ha'asirin v'nosmin lecha mamon harbeh. Ve'omer lahem, v'vakasha mechem, hotziuni hayom ve'einin nevakesh klum. Don't talk to me about all the riches I'm going to get tomorrow. If you can get me out today, that's what I want. Right? So I'm reading this almost as the Gemara is resisting that explanation. Right? That's not enough. That can't really explain the whole story, that it's a brief and hatzarim. It certainly wouldn't explain it from the perspective of Bnei Israel. It doesn't make any sense to them that they need the Rechush Gadol, unless it reinforces the point. True, it doesn't matter to you, but it matters to Avram. It matters to Hashem. Right? But it removes them from the episode completely. It's illogical from their perspective. Okay? We're going to come back to this source in another vector coming up. Okay, so don't read the last part of the Gemara. We'll see that too. Okay, now, in B, I'm moving quickly, but if you have comments or questions, please feel free to interrupt me. The beginning of nationhood, okay? This Midrash, which is taken from Bamidbar Rabba, and I'm violating my usual rules, which is not to just take from all over the place in the Midrashic universe, but for tonight's shiur I am, because there's so much information. This is a Midrash on Bamidbar. It's actually in the middle of the episode with Midian. Just so I don't misquote. This is in Bamidbar. Vayeshev Yisrael v'shiti. Okay. Halacha, bizchut kama dvarim nigalu Yisrael mimitrayim. Okay. It's in Bamidbar Rabba, so the question is really talking about the Jews in the Midbar, and it has nothing to do with where we are here. You'll see at the end what it's connected to. But the question begins, on account of how many things were the Jews redeemed? So I mentioned very early the question that Aviva Zorberg asked, the redeemability of the people, right? Is this something that they deserved? Or the other trend in the Midrash to say, no, they sunk to the 49th level, and it was only Hashem's grace that took it out. But this is already asking the question, it has to be on account of something. Right? If you're so, so low, you can't go from 49 to underweight 169. So on account of what? And you're probably all familiar with the answers in one way or another. Shanu Rabotenu, Bishut Arba Dvarim, Nigalu Yisrael Mitzrayim. Shaloshinu Shmotan, Shaloshinu Lashonam, Velogilu Nistorin Shalahem, Shemoshe amar lehem v'sha'ala isha mishchenta klechasef uflei v'hav v'hayar hadavar hadem muzkad etzlam yudbet chodesh v'lo gila echad mehem lemitzrayim. And number four, but we'll come back and explain, v'lo nifutzu ba'arayot. Okay, so we get this list of four, which you've probably seen in a different form, right, elsewhere. And there's a different version of this midrash, which is a little bit misogynist, so I chose the Bani Barbaba version, but it's the same list of four. Didn't change their names, didn't change their language. Lo gilu mistalim shalahem. Anyone want to take a crack at translating that? Well, a clue is that mistorin is actually a Greek word. Okay, like mystery, the Greek is musterion, but it's like mystery, secret. They did not reveal their secret. What was the secret?
That they were going to
be... Okay, what they were going to do? What does the Midrash say? Moshe told them, V'shala Yisha Mishchenta, and this was Mufkad Eslam, almost like, it's almost a legal term, right? Mm-hmm. This was like a pikadon. This was stowed away with them for 12 months. V'lo gila echad mehem. In the misogynist version, the real surprise is that no woman told Lashon Hara about the other, right? So they didn't give each other away because women gossip, right? But in this version, it's not about women, although it is V'shala Yisha Mishchenta. It is a matter that they each had this mystery, they each had this secret, and they didn't reveal it. Now, I call this the beginnings of nationhood because the way that I'm understanding the source is that the kind of credit that they're given has nothing to do with the thing itself. It has nothing to do with the fact that they asked or didn't ask for the gold and silver. The fact is that they are credited for not revealing this mystery, meaning they understood already when they were in Mitzrayim that they were part of a group. They understood that the thing that they were told was important for them to keep within their own boundaries and not to spill over into the Egyptians. Because I'm assuming the understanding is, had even one of them told, the whole plan would have been foiled. Right? And it links up with the Sheloshinu Shmotam. They didn't change their names, they didn't change their languages, their language, and Loni Fertuba Arayot. These all have to do with boundaries, national boundaries. They understood who they were, but if you notice, they're all in the negative. This is a kind of very subtle way of crediting them. They didn't do anything, actually. They just didn't change. They didn't reveal. They were not correct about it. Okay? So this explanation is saying, well, the importance of the gold and the silver was almost like a test. Right? It was almost a test on God's part to see, can they do it? Can they understand that this is really important, that in the mind of a slave, your life is a 24-hour cycle, and all you can think about, especially as the Torah narrates it, is how you're going to manage to make enough bricks in the coming day. They were able to break out of that mindset and link together as a group. And so the gold and the silver, in this sense, functions as nudging them, edging them towards an understanding that they were a collective. Okay? But it's very subtle. Right, it can't be that they didn't tell each other because they all knew.
Right, so what would be the thinking even that they just tell?
Okay, so I think, right, I might be reading this into the source, but what they're, lo gila, in other words, they were clues. They understood that you don't just speak when it's something that is special. This is a secret that God was given to them. They had an awareness that God was speaking to them in a way that's different because of who they are as a group. I'm assuming on a logistical level, if they didn't have that awareness, they would just talk, something comes in, something comes out, because as a slave you have no sense of yourself as a human being, really. You have no sense that you know something that can't just be repeated out. And therefore, if they had done that, it wouldn't have worked. Okay, responses, yes.
Seems to me that that this source of understanding the plan to ask for it with no intention of it getting it back. In other words, it's a asking to borrow without the intention. That's why it has to be kept secret.
Mm-hmm.
So, as opposed to the actually just asking for it as a lesson.
Right, according to the way we're just explaining it, that it's important that they didn't do that so that the plan would work. Unless we're wrong about that. Unless that's not really it at all. It has nothing to do with the logistics. It was a test for them to be able to keep a divine secret within their boundaries. Yeah, but I think you're right.
Moshe, is that a Midian because they can't keep their mouth shut?
And the Rashis, particularly in the early Hakim of Shmot, keep harping on that idea that Moshe is so afraid, right? That when Vayarvi, you know, Vayarki and Ish, that he saw that nothing good was going to come of this people. Moshe, according to those Rashis, really has a sense of fear and despair about this whole lot of people, right? He would subscribe to that idea that they're not going to be able to do it. They're not worthy of being redeemed, and they're not going to amount to anything, right? And maybe this gold and silver, as we're seeing, is a counter to that idea. Yeah. Okay, good. So we mentioned this in the beginning. I don't remember if you were here, but that this is a question that occupies many of the Mefarshim. Okay, and I'm not dealing with that specifically tonight, but... No, it's true. And you'll see in some of the later explanations that it actually is important that it's asking. Okay? But I'd like to talk to you about it afterwards. Yeah.
I hear echoes there of this of the church in Petra. But it's supposed to the woman who didn't do so, which fits my parable that we just said about Russia, who were the ones responsible for keeping it going, the patient ones.
Right. It's misogynist in the sense that the assumption is that, of course, they would tell. These women did. And that does link up with those other Midrashim that credits the women for being responsible, really, for the whole of the Gula. But the assumption of that Midrash is different than the assumption. It's not about Sophist per se, but again, okay, we'll bracket that. Yeah.
So there's a tension here between being a slave and yet having an identity enough that they were credited with Shiloshino and Shimam and the Shimam. They have that much national identity. So they were sort of proud people. And on the other hand, maybe because they're slaves, they want so much to please their masters, they want to acculturate, they want to assimilate, that they're going to blab all this secret stuff potentially to them. It's like an interesting duality going on here.
Well, they don't do that, right, but they could have. They could have. Right, and I think all of these, right, Shiloshinu Shmotam, Shiloshinu Lashonam, you notice the Midrash doesn't bring any psukim to back that up, because the whole Torah is in Hebrew. Right, so in terms of the Lashon, there are other Midrashim that try to bring a support, but they're kind of weak because there's really no way out of reading Parol to speak in Hebrew. Right? The names also, what do we mean by the names? The support that's usually brought is, you know, they entered as Reuven, Shimon to Levi, and they leave as Reuven, Shimon. But what didn't they change exactly? That they referred to their forefathers in that way, or that they didn't call their children Rufus? Right? There's different versions of that Midrash. But again, they're very hard. Well, that would be the, you know, the equivalent. Not really Egyptian, but in any case. But this one, Logi Lu et Nisarin Shalahem, is there, but it's also under the surface. It's only if you read it in a certain way. Okay, I just want to move on to the next one. Do you mind if I hold your question? Okay, the symbols of marriage. Okay, now we're really getting going. Okay, those were the kind of subtle explanations, not totally satisfying. Hopefully, the next two will give you a new perspective. Okay, so it occurred to me as I was looking at these sources that Yechezkel will be an important place to look, because Yechezkel, in Perek Tet Zayin, right, has this very long perek where he describes Bnei Yisrael in metaphorical language as a cast-off baby, right? And there's a pasuk smack in the middle of Yechezkel. If you look, did the highlight come out in the Xerox? Oh, great. Okay, so pasuk Zayin, right? If we're familiar with this, is of course, right, the Damai Chayi. So, Revava Ketema Chasadena Tatich, Vatirbi, Vatigdili, Vatavoi, Vadi Adayim, Shadayim Nachonu Usarech, Tameach, Taat, Erom, Ve'aryah. So this is a parak, right, where God is describing the spectacle of Bnei Israel as a baby, cast off, uncared for, bloody, in the field, and God comes and sees this spectacle, sees this vision, and then in Pasuk Zion it starts to turn around because this baby is no longer a baby. This baby is this letting out a lesson perhaps, or certainly a beauty. And the words Vatavoi Ba'adi Adayim, which are very difficult to render, again, preoccupied these in the Farshim. Radak has a very interesting explanation. Radak on the bottom of your page says, Vatavoi Ba'adi Adayim. Bat le'et sha'at ru'uya la'adi Adayim. Not that you came to Adi Adayim, which I don't have it open in front of me, but many translators will say you were, you had great attraction, or you were very, very beautiful. Radak says, no, Vatavoi, you reached the age where you were worthy of Adi Adayim. What are Adi Adayim? Jewels. Kina'ara shu'giyazmana li'yot li'ish, ra'ui le'adoka v'tachshitim na'im. So she was at the age where she deserved to be, you know, bedecked with, adorned with jewelry. What's Adi Adayim? The tov uve'yafa sheba adim, kamo melech melechim. Right, not just any old jewels, but the best. Klomar, man Yisrael higia la'seit min ha'galut, kamo she'amar pachot ha'kari yechem, ve'et ha'asui la'sam b'mitzrayim, ve'omer ha'aleh ha'me'oni mitzrayim, ve'ha'adi hu klei chesef u'klei zahav u'smalot she'nitzlu et mitzrayim. So what were these jewels? The jewels were the gold and silver that God commanded them to ask from the Egyptians. And then I realized, look on the top of the page, in Bereishit, Perek Vavdalu, when the Eved is sent to find Rivka, when they agree, or are almost agreeing, to the deal, in Pasuk Nun Gimel, Vayotze Ha'eved Klechesef Uflei Zahav U'Bgadim, Vayitein L'Rivka, U'Migdanot Natan Machia U'Lehima. So one small change, Smalot and Begadim, but essentially it's the same phrase. This is like a traditional betrothal gift. So now all of a sudden we're thinking about Hashem and Bnei Yisrael at this moment in Mitzrayim as, sorry again to be crass, but a couple going to register. Right? This is the symbols, the Klei Chesed, the Klei Zahav, Smalot, are the symbols of the upcoming wedding. Right? The wedding, perhaps, our Sinai, right? What? Okay, wait. So it's a rather strange registry. But here we have it. It's a betrothal gift. This should be. This is a gift that God is giving to the Jewish people as a kalah, as a way of signifying that they are about to come together as a couple. This, of course, fits very nicely with what's happening in these times, that the Jewish people are starting to develop this relationship with God that's totally unlike what they had before. This is the beginning of the Am. This is the beginning of the beginning, right? Perek Gimel in particular, they don't even know about it. It's just Moshe and Hashem at the Sneh discussing it. But the Klei Chesed, or Klei Zahav, or Smalot could be this kind of symbol of where they're headed. Now, of course, this is a strange gift because they're told to ask for it from somebody else, right? The donor is off, right? The Mitzrim are the ones who are supplying the jewelry for this betrothal gift from God to the Jewish people. Okay, which is why we need to turn the page. Okay, and on the next page, we have a very different idea about Klei Chesed V'Klei Zahav, but I think will also bring us to the marriage idea back. Okay, I entitled it Liberation, although I could have entitled it many things. It begins with Hapsukim and Devarim, bringing in really another kind of resonance to this issue. Now, in Devarim, we're learning about Eved Ivri. And when an Eved Ivri is sent off, right? Well, first we find out, V'chim kim korlecha asecha ha'ivri o ha'ivriya, v'avadcha sheish shanim, u'vashana ha'shvi'i t'shalfenu chofshi ne'ima. So an Eved can only work for 6 years, and on the seventh year you have to send them free. V'chi t'shalfenu chofshi ne'ima, lo t'shalfenu reikam. By the way, reikam, we saw in Perek Gimel. Okay? Very unusual word, actually. And here we have it in both places. When you send them, don't send this Eved empty, barehanded. Hanek ta'aniklo mitzamcha o migranecho miyakvecha asher berachacha Hashem alokecha titen lo. V'zacharta ki Eved hayita be'eretz Mitzrayim v'yetecha Hashem alokecha al keid anochi mitzavcha t'adavar hazeh hayom. The link to Mitzrayim is only extra credit. Right? But already we see here this idea that when a slave is sent free, a marker of the severance of that relationship between master and slave is here. Now you need your own things. Number one, because you came here poor, and now you are leaving, you can be a full member of society, and you actually do need money or stuff in order to function in society. And it's a personal marker between the master and the slave. I no longer have any authority over you. You are an independent player. So if we look at the Yetziat Mitzrayim story, what should happen on its own is that when the Jews are leaving Mitzrayim, they should be given gold and silver. They should be given stuff from the Mitzrayim as a way of liberating them, and psychologically as a way of marking their new identity. Now there's two problems here. Okay? There's two problems here, and we saw this in that Gemara where I didn't want you to look at the last few lines, right? And I put it again here in this section. There's two problems. If you look down in Talmud Bavli, right, Masechta Brachot, Vayashilum, Amar Rav Ami, Melamed Shehishilum Ba'al Korcham. It teaches us that this was against their will. Against whose will? Ikeda Amrei Ba'al Korcham de Mitzrayim, Ikeda Amrei Ba'al Korcham de Yisrael. I want to read it as both. Not either or, right? Okay? Not either or, but it's possible to read it as it being against the will of each party. This was not as the Devarim lays it out. The time comes, the master says, you're leaving, here are your goods. In Yetziat Mitzrayim's story, neither party was ready for that encounter. Neither party was ready to embrace the fact that this relationship, sick as it was, and unhealthy as it was ready to leave, was ready to be severed. If you think about it from the perspective of the Jews, right, and this is our second source here, the perspective of the Jews, gold and silver, right? There, why are they unwilling? Perhaps take a look at the Mechilta says, "Uvnei Yisrael asu kidvar Moshe, v'chi ma'amar lehem Moshe b'Mitzrayim, harehu omer daber na be'oznei ha'am v'yashilu v'gomer v'chein asu b'nei Yisrael, v'yishalu b'Mitzrayim chaseset v'chlei zahav v'smalot, she'ein tamud lomar v'smalot ela hakasut hayta chaviva alehem yoter mechaseset v'zahav." I read that quickly. What is the Midrash pointing out? What we noticed already, that the smalot drops out of the second source and returns to the third source. But also, why mention smalot? If they're being asked or told to ask for gold and silver, who cares about a few extra pairs of clothes? What's the answer of the Midrash? From the perspective of the Jews, the kasut was chavivah. The clothing was much more dear to them and much more important to them than gold and silver. Again, slaves. Okay? Slaves not yet ready to leave. The slave who said, I don't care about all this gold and silver, just get me out of here. To them, getting some clothing was actually more significant than the gold and the silver. And when I think about this liberation model, I've been thinking in child development terms. What do I mean? Sometimes, with children, they need to be given the language to be able to do something, right? A slave should be able to ask for something when they're leaving. That is an essential piece of humanity, to be able to ask, to have a question, to want something, to ask for it, maybe get it, maybe not get it. The Jews needed to be able to ask, but they weren't ready to ask. They weren't ready developmentally in their continuum to be able to go to the Egyptians and say, we are the Jews, we are leaving, give us what we need. So what does God have to do? God had to set up the scenario for them. God had to give them the language, give the Jews the language to ask, and as we saw by Yitain Chain, right, God had to impose Chain on the Mitzrim. They also were not ready to give. Right? We think about it from the perspective of Paragimel, Paragidal, Paragibet. Sometimes with children also, you tell them something way ahead of time so that they'll begin to think about it, right? In Paragimel, they were definitely not ready to ask for gold and silver and clothing. Paragidal, the night was coming. They had to go, right? They had to leave. The hate that we talked about, remember those dissonant images, now become less dissonant. They had no time to pack their food, and there also was no time anymore to wait for them to be able to ask. So God says, Daberna, just go to them and please tell them now they need to ask for it. Now they need to go to the Egyptians. This is what they need to say. It just occurred to me when I was with a friend and my 4-year-old and her 3-year-old, and they were dancing around each other the whole day fighting, and we realized they just wanted to play, and neither one could say, will you play with me? So we actually said, go to her and say, will you play? This is obvious to all of you, but I'm a young mother, right? And once they were able to use those words, they played beautifully. And I realized that could be what's happening here. they can't yet ask, that's what Devarim, that's the ideal. But God instead has to nudge them, has to say, okay, here's going to be the encounter, here's the scenario. It's not real, because they're not ready for it yet, but we're going to force you into it. The other piece of this, of course, is the title of tonight's talk, Transitional Objects, right? This relationship between the Jewish people and Mitzrayim, which they're not yet ready to have that face-to-face encounter, I ask you give, the Jews are also really not ready to leave Egypt. And they're not ready to leave this unhealthy relationship that they have with the Egyptians. And so perhaps the gold and the silver, again, in developmental terms, is a kind of surrogate for Mitzrayim, giving the Jews a little bit of Egypt, so that even though they're not ready to leave, they can take a little bit of Egypt out with them, right? The pacifier, the blanket, a way of remaining connected to Mitzrayim. Of course, it's a very perverse use of the transitional object because Mitzrayim is not the mother in any way. They're leaving, absolutely, Mitzrayim, but as we know, it takes a very, very, very long time for the Jews to leave Mitzrayim. Okay, that's what the desert is all about.
And they keep talking about
going back. And we have these overlapping relationships that need to get worked out in the desert. This marriage between God and the Jewish people, this new emerging relationship that the objects are also essential in helping prep them for, and leaving this unhealthy relationship with Mitzrayim also takes a lot of time. That's the 40 years. Now there's one more piece, and that's E, too much of a good thing. Okay? Sometimes with transitional objects, right, a child becomes overly attached to the object, and then you have to help the child be weaned from the object. Forget the symbol. The object becomes more than the object itself. That could be what happens with the Jews as well. You all know this Rashi. Right after Shirat Hayam, it says, Vayasa Moshe. Moshe made them leave, as opposed to saying, Vayisa Ha'am. Mm-hmm. Right? That the nation just went on their own accord. What does Rashi say? Well, this is actually the Tanhuma. This is the fuller source. Vayasa Moshe, Shehesian Ba'al Korchan. He forced them to go, he forced them to travel. Shelo B'tovatan. Against with their own sense of good. Ketzad, Ela b'sha'ah sheyatzu Yisrael m'Mitzrayim, yatza Paro lirdof otam b'chol otam ha'uklosin. Right, when Paro ran after them, he ran after them with his whole army. Shne'emar v'yikas sheish me'od rechav v'chor. Ma'asa, amad v'kishet kol otam ha'susim v'avanim tolot u'margaliot. He didn't really run after them, right, without bringing all of his riches and adorning the horses, probably because he was sure of a victory parade, right? And so the horses weren't just going to come back, you know, as they left in haste. They came back, they were going to come back properly. Kishaba'u layam v'teva'an ha-kadosh baruch hu, hayu tzafin asfat hayam, kol otan ha'avanim tolot u'margaliot v'hayu mushlachim. What happened? They entered the sea, and of course they were drowned. And after the fact, all of those beautiful jewels and pearls were tzafim. What's tzafim? They were floating on the banks of the river. They were strewn about. Hayu mushlachim. V'hayu Yisrael yordin b'chol yom. They weren't scuba diving, but I think yordin meaning they left their encampment and they were going back down to the site of the yam, v'notlin mehen v'lo hayu mevakshim lazuz misham. Right? They were so busy, maybe, or they were so enamored by, they were so caught up with the objects of Mitzrayim that they didn't want to leave. That was enough for them. The objects were enough. Right? These are not the same objects, of course. Right? These are not the gold and the silver that they asked for, but it is the bizarre, it is the jewels, the beauties of Mitzrayim that have now come to them in this really overwhelming, you get the sense from Moshe's perspective, in a nauseating way. Right? The Midrash continues, Kevan shera'a Mosheka amar lahem ma'atem tzivurim shebechol yom hayam ma'aleh lachem avanim tovot u'margaliot amad behesiyan ba'al kurchan. So he turns to them and he says, what do you think? Every day there's going to be more and more and more and more. There's no end to this. Did they respond? Did they say you're right? No. Ahmad Behesian Ba'afrachan. Right? So they couldn't be, they were stuck in that stage. They were stuck staring at Bizat Hayam. And in many sources you see a comparison, which was greater, Bizat Hayam or Bizat Mitzrayim? Which had more stuff? Okay, so the two are connected already. Moshe says, I just got to get you out of here. I have to drag you out. And sometimes that happens also, developmentally, right? I'm just going to have to use force here and move you on because we have no time to wait. And it was too dangerous for the narrative of God and Jewish people. This other important relationship that's developing is being stagnated by your constant returning and returning and returning to the site of the Yam. One last idea. This was the source that originally got me excited about the topic. I could not include it, although it doesn't fit neatly into any of the categories. This is, I think, maybe the most provocative of all the sources. It appears here in Avot Rabbi Natan, but there's a parallel also in the Gemara in Pesachim. And I'll just tell you outside. It says, Shlosha chazru limkoman. Three things return to their places. The three in this list are Yisrael, the Jewish people, HaTorah, HaKesef VaHazahav. In the Bavli, it's also Yisrael. Instead of Torah, it's Ketav Luchot. Ketav Luchot. And Kesef HaZahav. I think there it's called Zahav Mitzrayim. The most shocking on this list of things that return to their places, well, I shouldn't spoil it for you, tell me. The first one, Yisrael, begins by saying, well, the Jewish people began, their origins are the Eder Hanar, right, the other side of the river, and they return there, to Babel. Okay, the proof, the pasuk, which is quoted to support this idea from Ezra, but particularly in the Bavli, the rabbis were living this reality. They were living in Babel, and of course you can see already my understanding of that, of this passage, in a way that they were justifying their reality. Right? This is our origins, this is where we belong. Of course, circumventing the centrality of Eretz Yisrael. Right? But there's a kind of rightfulness to this circle. We begin and we end in the same place. The second on this list, HaTorah, begins in Hashemayim. Okay, there's no need for an explanation for that. Although the Midrash quotes the pasuk, "Atem re'item ki min Hashemayim dibarti imachem." Of course, the Torah is divine in origin, and according to this text, it returns min koma, a very obscure pasuk of Mishle, which in context is not talking even about wisdom, but it is used here. You see it. It is gone. It grows and flies away like an eagle up to the heavens. Okay, the Midrash is using that as a way of saying, I don't know exactly what, that the Torah returns to Shamayim. This is not the Lo B'Shamayim Hi, right? This is not the tradition which says we have control, we fight it out. This is saying actually there's a kind of circularity and the Torah will return, or the Torah does return, or the Torah always is divine. And then finally, for our purposes, HaKesef VaHazahav were from Mitzrayim, as we know. And how do we know they returned? Because in Malachim, and as repeated in Divrei Hayamim, Shishach Melech Mitzrayim comes and raids Otsarot Beit Hashem and Otsarot Beit HaMelech, and it specifically says there that he also takes gold. Okay? So again, there's a kind of circularity. Talk about swallowing. This Midrash swallows everything we just said, right? Because in a way it just returns, it goes full circle. It also speaks to the anxiety of the ethical issues, right? Because this Midrash is admitting, well, it really was the Egyptians, and don't worry, it goes back to them. So don't blame us, right? But I think it also points to other ways of exploring this issue. What are the connections between this and the Torah and Israel? Is this so central that it belongs on a list with Torah and Israel, right? What is this passage trying to say about the role of the gold and silver in at least the Shoah narrative, if not the larger narrative of Jewish history? Okay, so that's the end of my part. I would love to hear some comments, suggestions, or answer any questions that you might have. Yeah.
One thing that you didn't really address, which I found very fascinating, is that all three sources emphasize the chayim, that it's important. And it seems directly contrary to saying that this is Baal Karsam, the Mitzrim. In fact, that's his point, that they should be motzei chayim, What's that all about?
Well, I don't think it's so opposite, because it doesn't say that Mas'uchin, it says Venatatichin. So this is, it's akin to God hardening Paro's heart. Right? This is a created emotional bond. It doesn't say, right? I mean, depends how you understand Mas'uchin. Right? But it sounds like, at this very moment, how could you say otherwise? How could you say that after Makata Farot, the Egyptians were warm to the Jews? Right? That they were, if anything, my image of it is that they were like doormats. They said, take whatever you want, because nothing matters now. Right? And actually, in some of the sources which I didn't show you, which may be a way of understanding that difficult verb, but it says, well, the Jew would ask for the hammer, and the Egyptian would say, take the whole toolbox. Right? So either you could read that as generosity, or you could read that as, I really don't care about my stuff. Just take whatever you want, just get out of here. So what's that saying? What is that saying? Is that real, or is it crafted? Is it for the moment? Because as I was trying to suggest, they weren't ready for it on their own. Or, as some of the sources say, well, what do you expect from Egyptians? Right? So God had to create that for them. I didn't come across it with this humor, but
yes.
It fit very well with the idea of they're asking for clothing.
But it's probably
it flies in the face of my reading of the clothing. But not necessarily, if you just say kusut chaviva like them, well then, yeah, kusut is chaviva because it's meaningful to them.
I'm not going to insist on all the Russian subtitles.
They should. They don't. Right. Right. No, but in other words, it's that Midrash does point to the idea that smalot are significant to them. Right? It doesn't explain why they would say we want more. But not changing smalot doesn't mean they never did laundry. Right? It means that they retain their dress. Right? They retain their traditional dress.
The version of the last piece in Aron Sukkah, you said it's but I heard that, especially when the first one, that they wind up back in Aron Sukkah.
Could be. I mean, that one, just not directly related to what you just said, but the Ktav Lufot is a little bit easier to understand why you would say begins and ends in Shamayim, less so than you would say the whole Torah. Right? Because it says very clearly, Moshe broke the Lufot, and this is understanding, well, therefore, the Ktav, you know, went up. Ktav,
and
not
assuming
left.
That Sub-Shuri, Sub-Shuri,
they're conflicting midrashim. It's really interesting. There are some that say they specifically didn't go during the 3 days of Choshech, and therefore, when the Jews asked, the midrashim said, of course, you're trustworthy. You didn't take anything during the 3 days, therefore we'll give you now. And then there are those that say, that's when they did it. Yeah, that's when they took it. And then there are the midrashim which say, why the women? Because the women, well, there are many other traditions. Okay, and it, like I said, there's really a wealth of information. I tried to, you know, focus the sources into particular ways of understanding the significance of the home motif. But there are many, many sources that are captured by, you know, the logistics and really the significance of this encounter. Okay.
Your comments trigger another thought that perhaps is another dimension. Are a message of justice, and the spalot are a message of identity. By that I mean, you know, I've often been accused of seeing a lot of things through the eyes of the Holocaust, so I'm not going to stop tonight. Gold and the silver could have been reparations, straight out reparations for the many hundreds of years of servitude, of intense servitude, that a Kodesh Baruch Hu built in, that there is justice in the world. You're going to be oppressed. You're going to be going through all that time, and I'm going to square things with you. And the Egyptians are going to have to pay up for that. And I'm going to create that circumstance. That's that part. The smalot may be an expression of wishing as a slave, wanting to be an Egyptian. I see these guys walk around. I was at the King Tut exhibit a few months ago, so
you're really struck by the clothing that remains, the gilded clothing, the very brocaded clothing, which is marvelous. So if I'm a slave and I'm watching these people walk around with this all the time, and the rest of them are in the white Egyptian linen, which is so valuable, I may really lust for that, because that means to me that's identity, that's freedom. So I'm told first, Moshe's told, they're going to ask for those three things. And then before Makat Bechora, when I, as a Jew, am not really convinced I'm going out yet, because we've had all these plagues and I haven't gotten this anymore. So I'm only told about the gold and silver, because the identity part I can't relate to yet, potentially.
Then how do you explain that they actually do bring that?
And then at the end, this is the clincher to me. At the end, when they realize they're leaving, it's really happening, and they're in a rush, they treat clothing the way it should be treated, as a utensil. They wrap it around them. And they understand that that's really what clothing is, just utensil.
But it seems strange to understand why, therefore, it would be a command from God. If it's an identity, the way you're explaining it, that it's an identity of really a lustful identity, it's not the identity that God is prepping them for, it seems strange that this would be a sibui. I'm more convinced by the idea of thinking of it as a preparation for their new life that's involving God, that's taking them way out of Egypt, taking them to something else. Right? And there are, you know, you have to, the postscript to all of this, of course, is Chet HaEgel and the Mishkan. Right? They actually did need stuff in the desert. Right? It was this wasteland, but they built beautiful things with Tovulura. Again, possibly two different ways of working out that relationship. Chet HaEgel, on the face of it, has nothing to do with Mitzrayim. Right? It's other problems they have. But of course it is. Of course it is HaEgel. And it's this still fixation with the object and fixation with this this other form of deity that they saw. And so what they did with the gold and silver was another way of working out those overlapping relationships.
Yeah. But this implies that even though they were lauded to the fact that they didn't change their dress, they left Egypt and they took Egyptian clothes with them and then they dressed like Egyptians. What was the point of that?
So all of this is beyond what I was trying to suggest, because I first didn't even see that source about the smalot. Not that I can therefore say it doesn't exist, but the kind of what you see in the psukim and in the sources is not the dressing like the Egyptians, right? If anything, you see it as either just clothing in a utilitarian value or this other identity which has to do with the previous identity. But yeah, it's complicated. It's complicated. Yes.
I think that, you know, whenever people leave Egypt, they leave with wealth, right? Like Abraham and Yitzchak. Even in the Yosef story, you know, when they come out of Egypt, it's so I think, you know, to find like, you know, explanation is you have to tie it in with all the different, you know, and I'm not sure, like something like reparation sounds like it's led simply to slavery, whereas it seems to be whenever the Jews leave Egypt, they leave with wealth.
Well, then, but why, right? Why is that? What's the connection between these shrine, wealth, and the Jews? Right, I mean, the reparations model, that's so interesting because I thought about that. Many sources say that. And maybe as not a Holocaust, a second generation, I thought, how could that be even connected to? What kind of insult is that? You're going to tell these people that are leaving, it's all okay now because we're giving you some gold and silver. The real insult of slavery seems to be the stripping of humanity, in which case gold and silver, as we hear from that Mechilta, they're saying, who cares? Just get me out of here. So it doesn't really work as that. It's the brief Bein HaTzarim answer, which kind of swallows them as real players, real subjects. Although, of course, there's historical precedent for reparations as being an appropriate response.
Let me just say that it may be a message to the Egyptians more than the Jews, that there's justice in the world. And if you're going to do this to people, you're going to have to pay.
Except Shishak gets it back.
Right.
Right. Right. Yeah. Right.
Two questions. One thing has to be emotional. If there's one person who does change, who does walk out of the Jewish name, and that motion, he's the only one, everybody else that keeps their Jewish names, he's the only one who either walks out of Egypt without a Jewish name. And in terms of what you're saying, taking something Egyptian out of them, it seems that to some extent the thing you're taking out, that some of it has something of Egypt, and it almost appears to be motion. He's the only one who doesn't change his name, and he's a former of teachers. Mm-hmm. And also in terms of Moshe, in terms of these forcing people to do something, which is the two biggest sins that the Jews have, which is the Chet HaEgel and the Marasim, all of them happens when Moshe is not there. If Moshe, there are sins that happen. happen from Horizon, there is whatever form that is when Moshe's not there, not being obviously by the ego. So the idea that Moshe is controlling and everything like that, as soon as Moshe lets go a little bit, the worst things possible tend to happen. That might be one of the reasons why Moshe has to control everything, force them, and things like that. Also, one last thing. In the last story that you had, all these three things that happen are bad things. You said maybe the rabbis are trying to justify being in Babel. All these three things are bad things. So they're saying that if they're in Babel, that's a bad thing. It's not a good thing.
Well, bad is good enough to put here, because Lachzor Lemakom is comforting, right? There's a kind of, it belongs here, goes back to where it belongs. Shishak, yes, you could say, raining the Osar Beit HaMelech on the face of it would seem like a bad thing. The Torah returning to Shemayim, in our version, is again, it's not clear that it's a bad thing, it's saying,
it's definitely a bad thing, because the proper place of the Torah is Shemayim,
right.
But where it's supposed to be is down here. The Torah is not supposed to be this part of the place.
Okay. I mean, I'm not sure about that, because the pasuk that the Midrash quotes is not about an event. It's not about the Jews. It doesn't say, how do we know the Torah was best because the Jews sin all the time? It's not. It's an essential piece of, I mean, we should look up the pasuk initially together, but it's not related to transgression. And then going to Babel, again, the proof text is not just about, about Galut, about them being exiled. It's not because of their racism. I don't know. I'm not sure.
This isn't South Africa. It's back home.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And we do know that there are many traditions where Chazal living in Babel would kind of, you know, to use a parable, resurrect, you know, the land as a rightful place, pointing out all of the biblical places where they live and kind of Gottman has an article about this where he really shows how Babel becomes, you know, reinscribed within the proper orbit. So I'm not sure if this is the source that would fit with that or doesn't.
There's been a lot of people that criticize people who left Babel to go to Eretz Yisrael.
Right.
As if they were sinning by leaving Mocking
Torah. Right. Can I just respond to some of your earlier comments, just very quickly? Number one, about Moshe's name. That's very complicated, right? And then the freshman really talk about this. Is it Hebrew or is it not Hebrew? Of course, the word Moshe and the etymology in the pasuk is Hebrew, giving him my Mishitu, right? And so there are all kinds of explanations. Is that what she said? Is that what someone else said? Is it translated? It's not so clear what kind of name that actually is. And also in terms of Moshe's role, I think you pointed out something to me which I hadn't even realized. This shiur in general underemphasizes Moshe and really talks about the Jewish people vis-a-vis Egypt and vis-a-vis God. Moshe becomes a kind of sub-player, although he's connected with all the Tzivuyim. This again is a larger tension whenever you talk about Shemot. Right? Think about the Haggadah. Moshe is completely underemphasized. Whose story is it really? Is it the Jew's story? Is it God's story? Is it Moshe's story? So this angle was really belittling him, and you were suggesting something, you know, a little bit different. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Rivka has looked for the location. That's something. I see it. Even she didn't find where she was in, but she didn't find it.
Now I want to find it. Thank you.
That'd be great.
Can you see that?
Have you
yet?
Not mine. Thank you very
much. Oh, there's Scott.
Well, the other thing I want to thank you for is your hearing to the
That's Rabbi Silber. That's Rabbi Silber, really.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sure, once you see it, you can't unsee it. Right, that it's not Elliot.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I don't know if it is, but let's not presume that it is.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah?
What's the point, Raymond?
We're going to have a goal soon.
I think I turned it off on
you. It's the
right. I find what the charm is. I think there's really
is, whatever you...
I disagree. I think that, I mean, this kind of...